At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down with eating disorder dietitian Zoe Davis. Zoe now specialises in mental health and eating disorders, and so we talk together, as she is a sports dietitian, about sports, exercise, disordered eating, eating disorders, and a whole host of other things. I really hope you enjoy this episode.
I can hear you very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? How's your Sunday?
Yeah, it was good. I feel like I don't know where it's gone. Like, I haven't done anything with it. I, like, woke up and I was like, right, I'm going to do some scrapbooking. And then went to the gym and came back and did some scrapbooking. And now it's 6 o'clock.
Sounds like a very relaxed Sunday.
Very relaxing. Yeah. How's your Sunday been? You had birthday celebrations.
Yeah. Well, it was my birthday on Friday. So I was just... I was just up with some friends. We had like a bit of a birthday weekend because it was my other friend's birthday today. So it was very nice. Yeah. It was just, lots of food and wine.
Nice, fun. Nice.
So it was good. Yeah, exactly what I needed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for doing this on your birthday weekend. Hopefully it won't ruin your weekend too much. I wondered if you wanted to start by just maybe sharing a bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Yeah, sure. So I am a dietitian. I'm based in Ireland. I think I graduated about, I'd say it's about 12 years ago now. So I've been working as a dietitian for about 12 years, but specializing in mental health and eating disorders for 7 years. And I've been kind of working as a freelance dietitian for the last few years. So providing kind of, I suppose, private services to individuals with eating disorders mostly, and then also working privately for the HSE, which is our kind of health service here in Ireland. So that's kind of what I've been doing over the last number of years.
Amazing. And what kind of led you, said you've been doing this for a while, but for 7 years you've been doing it in the mental health area. What was it that made you think, I'm going to move from dietetics to the mental health side of things?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. For me, I think it happened kind of organically. I was working in an area of dietetics called whole mental feeding. And basically, that is working with individuals who require kind of long-term feeding through tubes, because maybe they've had something like a stroke or motor neuron disease or something like that, which means that they can't kind of eat orally. So I was doing that work for some time and I really enjoyed it. It was very rewarding work, very interesting work. But I kind of realized that, you know, I kind of went into dietetics to work with food and to use food, to support people to improve their health and well-being. But in home mental feeding, you're using kind of prescribed products, so like pharmaceutical products like supplements and tube feeds. And although it has its place, I was just kind of, maybe it wasn't suiting kind of what I wanted to do as a dietitian. So a job just kind of came up in mental health and eating disorders, and I went for it. I think there's also, you know, my personal experience as well with mental health, through my father. My father kind of struggles with his mental health, and I think that probably, you know, definitely led me to have kind of more curiosity and interest, within the area. So I think that also kind of serves me as well you know, as a dietitian and at the moment as a practitioner working in the field, having that kind of personal experience, you know, I think it allows me to be, you know, compassionate and more understanding, because I've kind of had a, you know, lived experience of living and supporting someone with, you know, their mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, whether it's yourself or somebody that you love that's very close to you, having that experience to then bring that into kind of the work that you do is yes, the unique element, I think, which is really nice for the people that you're working with.
I think so. I think for me, it wasn't really an intentional thing. You know, I didn't think that when I was, you know, training as a dietitian, or even over my years of working as a dietitian, that was an area I was going to go into. I think, you know, it just happened kind of that way. But I think actually now I've realized it does really serve me, and it's an area that I'm so passionate about, I think, because of those personal experiences as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so how did you go, I guess it's like another kind of, you know, narrowing it down further, how did you go from the mental health kind of aspect of things to then eating disorders and the kind of sports dietitian?
Yeah, so I think the roles that I've had as a dietitian, they've been mental health dietitians, and that kind of covers both areas. So, you know, when I worked in an inpatient setting, you'd have kind of the eating disorder ward, but then you'd have the kind of general kind of mental health ward as well. And that's as well with my current work, you know, for the HSC, you know, it would be both sides. So it kind of comes under the umbrella. I think most of my clinical work is working with individuals with eating disorders, such a need and for that. And I suppose they'd have a, you know, higher priority as well in terms of kind of risk. So most of my private work would be working with individuals with eating disorders. I think the sports thing has come kind of later on, that I suppose is inspired by my own kind of, I suppose, joy and love for sport. I was a competitive swimmer as a teenager, so I was always quite sporty kind of growing up, and then stopped it for a good amount of time, and then kind of came back into sport when I moved back to Ireland 4 years ago. So I think it was inspired by my, you know, past experiences as a sports person, as a teenager, and then also, as you know, my current involvement in sport as well. I think that's what got me into the sports nutrition.
Mm-hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong, but was it when we spoke last time you said about you'd had an injury or something and you had to sort of rebuild your relationship with food and that, or like, you know, your relationship with food and exercise, and that was something that sort of inspired the work with the sports dietitian?
Yeah, I got the injury kind of, I suppose, during my master's, and so I got an injury earlier this year, and yeah, I think it, I suppose, it's more that I suppose it was an interesting thing as a dietitian to have that injury and to kind of have to then look more at my food and look more at my, you know, my exercise. And I wasn't able to do sport for a number of months. So I think it was another kind of good, you know, lived experience, I think, that I'll be able to help other people with in the future, because I kind of went through, you know, how difficult and challenging it is to, you know, cope with an injury. And, you know, I think physically and mentally as well, if you're doing a lot of sport and then you have to stop, all of a sudden it can be really challenging. So I think that's something that was really difficult over the last number of months. But I think it will help me as a dietitian, you know, when I'm working with sports people in the future, because I'll have that understanding of, you know, the challenge that people are faced with. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's really nice that you've got that understanding as well, because, you know, like you said, when someone is injured, it's for then a very difficult thing maybe to shift, you know, your food and your exercise and stuff. It was for somebody with an eating disorder that I imagine will be even more difficult, because their exercise and their food is such a big element of kind of their self-worth. And I guess, like, with that in mind, I think one thing we were going to talk about today was excessive exercise. And I think, you know, injury can link into that a lot. So what sort of, from your perspective of the things that you've doing your master's, when somebody is excessively exercising, what impact can that have?
We can think about this term, I don't know if you've heard of it, called low energy availability. So basically it's like this state where there's not enough energy kind of going in to meet the kind of basic functions of the body. So that's to meet our kind of basal metabolic rate, which is kind of, you know, the minimum amount of energy our body needs to function at rest. So That's for functions like our cell production, respiration, digestion, all these kind of functions, circulation, these kind of vital functions that our body needs to survive. So when we're in a state of low energy availability, there's not enough energy coming in, which allows those functions then to not work properly. Or it can happen if you're maybe over exercising and not taking in enough energy to kind of balance that exercise. What happens is, if that's kind of if that's over a longer period of time, so if there's a consistent intake of low energy, or if you're over exercising, then it is going to have kind of effects on the body, so kind of physical and psychological effects. So there's numerous effects. It's kind of a multi-system effect, ranging from impacts to menstrual cycles, so hormones, to bone health, to impacts on the heart function, respiratory function, digestion. It's a broad spectrum of things in terms of physical health, and then also the psychological health as well. So we know that it in terms of athletes, and it can result in this syndrome called REDS, which is called relative energy deficiency syndrome, and which is like the state of low energy availability that causes this kind of multitude of kind of physical issues that happen. And then, as well as the physical implications, it can also obviously impact on performance if someone has if someone's an athlete in kind of training. So there's the two kind of sides to it, where their health is affected, and but also the performance side is affected too.
Yeah, and it's a double-edged sword, isn't it, really? Because people kind of have that drive to maybe lose weight, or to, some sports require you to be at a low weight or something like that. But at the same time, that's really affecting your performance. So I think my kind of question from that is, we understand that in order to perform well, you need to eat an adequate amount. But how do you know?
I think that's a good question. I think a lot of people underestimate, what an adequate amount is. I think, I suppose if you're unsure, you can get support and guidance from someone like a nutritionist or a dietitian. But, everyone's needs are different. So, it's difficult for me to say, excuse me, what your requirements are without kind of doing an assessment with you. And even that can be, skewed with different, miscalculations and whatnot. So I suppose, everyone's needs are going to be different, and it's hard sometimes for people to determine what the adequate amount is. So if someone's doing a high level of sport, I'd always be kind of, I suppose, prompting them to engage with someone like a sports nutritionist, so they can get that right advice. Because I think you're quite right, in terms of like that sport area, there is this kind of culture of having a low fat body composition or high muscle mass, and there's such misconceptions around that, and often for sports people, when I work with sports people, that can be the thing that they come wanting to do is to change body composition, and they're not kind of, I suppose, mindful of the impact that that can have on performance. So it's just about dropping weight or dropping fat, but they're not actually cognizant of the fact that if they do that too much, it can have a significant impact on performance, a negative impact on performance.
Yeah, and I find it really interesting, because I think we are aware of the negative impact that it can have on performance, but there's still that drive for that low body weight, and almost a normalization of kind of being able to perform at your best whilst kind of, not gaining weight or not kind of eating more than you maybe deem necessary. Like, where do you think that normalization's come from in terms, because I don't know, I can't imagine that, or maybe there is, because it's just like a broader thing of society in terms of like the lower the weight.
I mean, the performance equals better. I suppose it depends on the type of sport. But there is some evidence that suggests that, a certain, level of body, lower body fat may, be beneficial for sports, so say like a gravitational sport, like, cycling or something. But I suppose there's a fine line between what could be beneficial and then what becomes harmful. So I think, it's something that's within the culture of sport, where, as we've said, where, there's often a drive to manipulate body composition or reduce weight. I think it's about, trying to change that culture within the sport. So, trying to educate people on, I suppose, the implications of it, the risks of it, and really working towards changing the overall culture. Because I think even within certain sports, for example, like, you know, dancing or ballet or even cycling itself or endurance sports like long distance running or triathlon, there is this culture, or even like, you know, weight category sports, there's a culture of having lower being less. So, you know, it's really, really about education and screening and truly trying to promote and the fact that that's not always the best thing for people.
Yeah, undoubtedly. I think you're right. I used to do powerlifting, and like the first time that I did a competition, it was, you know, I was sat just above a weight category and it was automatically, well, you're obviously cutting down then, aren't you? And it's like, why can't I just be at the weight that I am? And this is my first competition ever. It's that normalization of, you know, if you can just get yourself to a little bit of a lower weight, then you'll be lifting heavier weights than everybody else.
Yeah. You know, they're thinking about the moment, you know, and often they're not thinking about the long term impacts. And, you know, we know that disordered eating, you know, more so than eating disorders, is widely used in sport. The increased risk of developing an eating disorder.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
If you're experiencing disordered eating, it's higher if you're experiencing disordered eating. So there's more of a chance of you actually developing an eating disorder. So I think we need to be educating people on that and the risks associated with that, because I don't think people realize that it's almost like people don't know that those behaviors that they're engaging in are disordered. You know, these kind of practices, they just think that it's part of the culture because it's been being so normalized, you know. And so, for example, like you're saying, the weight category sports, it's so normalized to cut weight before, you know, a competition to get into that lower weight category. And so that's part of the culture. And I think it's really about trying to work towards changing the culture, and because the consequences can happen within the moment. So there are short term consequences, but also the long term implications of that. You know, even for people developing, you know, a poor relationship with food, you know, often, you know, there's some evidence, you know, showing that weight category individuals, you know, develop things like binge eating because, you know, they've restricted their intake so much, and then later on they might binge after a competition. So, you know, it's kind of embedding this kind of poor relationship with food and that just grows over time, you know, and it has like long term implications then for health and, you know, physical and psychological health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting what you said about binge eating, because I was watching what's it called? I can't remember the name of it. It's like At Home with the Furies or something, but it's the Tyson Fury documentary, which actually I didn't think I would enjoy it, and I actually thoroughly enjoyed it. But one thing that I found interesting was Tommy Fury, Tyson's brother, was also doing a boxing match, and he needed to make weight for the match. And so for 8 weeks he had been on like a really strict diet, and then after the match he was like, I just can't stop eating, because my body's been under restriction, like I cannot stop eating. And I thought like it was an interesting concept, because he'd completely normalized that, because he's grown up with boxing, and you know, cutting weight for a competition is just what he kind of does. And I don't know, but from the way it was on the documentary, he didn't seem overly fazed by the fact that he couldn't stop eating. But I imagine for a lot of people, if you are in that restrictive state and then you come out of that and you can't stop eating, mentally, you know, if that was me personally, I'd find that really challenging.
That's kind of the body's response following restriction, you know, so it can be a common thing, you know, even for people that experience eating disorders, if they're more experiencing like a restrictive eating disorder, you know, sometimes they can end up binging later on because it's that kind of, you know, the body's been in restriction for so long, you know, it's like kind of like a response. I think when the brain understands and knows that there's food coming in on a consistent, regular basis, then it feels safe. And then that kind of tends to drop down. And if someone's managing to have a consistent intake and, you know, managing activity levels, you know, that tends to go away. But it can be a common thing where people do tend to binge because of that restrictive element, you know, and I think, it can be something that kind of comes up for people.
And I was just thinking then when you were saying about like we need to educate people about sort of like ensuring that they're eating enough and disordered eating and ensuring that doesn't lead to an eating disorder. And I think like I don't know what goes on in sort of like semi-professional or, you know, professional sports and stuff, but I can, my perspective there would be that that would be the coach's role to educate their coaches and stuff like that. But I'm just thinking about more like the general population, because like if I think about my gym environment, like I'm sure there are a lot of people there that just found a program online and potentially have gone from not doing any exercise to exercising, and now they've not changed their diet. They're probably in a calorie deficit, but not realizing the impact that that's going to have.
You know, as dietitians, it could be, you know, targeting gyms and going, working with gyms to, you know, do education with, you know, personal trainers in the gym or something like that. And that's something that I actually have been thinking about doing. And because I think even if you're in the gym yourself, you can see the things that are going on in there that might not be so helpful for people. And so I think, so yeah, I suppose dietitians and nutritionists targeting gyms to maybe provide that education and training. But I think it's almost like, you know, gyms are also even not aware of some of those issues. You know, they're not aware of things going on. So it's not like they would be, you know, taking that responsibility to try and, you know, approach a dietitian or a nutritionist typically, because they're not really maybe aware of the dangers or the risks, I think.
Do you think they have a responsibility in that?
Yeah, I think, you know, particularly if someone is restricting and over exercising and, you know, they've, you know, their body weight has dropped and there's kind of those physical risks that are kind of present. I think for sure they definitely have a responsibility. I mean, they might say otherwise, but I would say that they do. I know when people are, you know, going to the gym, they're adults and they're making that decision and choice to go there. But I definitely think there needs to be kind of more screening or you know, discussion with people before they start, you know, using machines and using the gym in that way. And I think certainly, you know, there should be training with personal trainers and things like that, because I mean, you know, they're there on a day-to-day basis in the gym, they're doing one-to-ones with people. Typically personal trainers will have some, you know, knowledge of nutrition, but I mean, it's not very specialist, and often they can give, you know, inappropriate advice to people. So I think it's about working together, you know, with personal trainers and people at the gym to provide the right education and training, and so that they give the right advice and support people in the best way.
I'm kind of like, oh, I don't know what level of responsibility the gym has. I think from my perspective, maybe having a sign up saying like, you know, are you struggling to have a rest day, or like, you know, are you confused about your nutrition, things like that, just so that people have somewhere to go in case they are struggling, because I feel like it would be difficult,
or yeah, of course, yeah,
I think it would be unfair to put that on the gym to be like, you have to spot the people. And also, you know, you can't see that everyone has an eating disorder, so it could be the case that, you know, And somebody could lose weight and be doing that for a health reason. Somebody else could be engaging in really disordered behaviours. But I do think that personal trainers have a responsibility, because personally, I've never had a personal trainer, but like, you know, I've seen them in the gym and, you know, see the chats that they have. And often they're having like, you know, people really like, they trust their personal trainers and they tell them a lot of things. So, you know, that would be, I think, a great opportunity to check in and say, you know, how are you finding this? And you know, how...
Yeah.
Are we pushing you too hard, or like, what's the balance? How are you finding your nutrition and stuff? And then to, you know, be able to support
them with that, and to not kind of expect gyms to spot people in that way.
They have a responsibility to have a balanced view of you know, in, you know, their attitude towards nutrition or exercise within the gym. So, you know, the stuff that they have on posters or that kind of thing. I feel like, you know, typically in gyms, it's all driven towards weight loss and, you know, cutting and restricting, you know, so that it's not so balanced. So I think they have an attitude in that sense to maybe provide more of a balanced, you know, information to people. Yeah.
Because not everybody at the gym is there to lose weight.
Absolutely not. No, people are going to the gym not, you know, not to be just constantly, you know, wanting to lose weight, because a lot of people are there to lose weight, and it will be good to the, you know, to get to a point where people are just there for improving their mental health and there to kind of, you know, improve their mood or whatnot, and it not being driven by, you know, body image and kind of, you know, numbers going down on scales. I think that would be a good place to get to.
Yeah, absolutely. And to find something that you enjoy as well. Like, I often think people think that the gym is just about going in and like lifting heavy weights or like running on a cardio machine for an hour. And there's so much more that you can do, and you can find things that you enjoy. But also, you know, in order to have a healthy lifestyle, you don't even need to go to the gym. There's so many different forms of physical exercise that you can do, and that will make you feel good, you know, if the gym isn't the space that you feel good. I kind of wanted to speak a bit more about the eating disorder side of things, and just kind of, I guess, speak about exercising. And I know that everybody will sort of be different, so we'll just caveat that beforehand. When you're working with clients, do you have sort of like a timeline or like a guide in your mind of when it might be suitable for them to return to exercise if they've stopped exercising?
You talk about from the outset, so I suppose exercise isn't always part of everybody's eating disorder, and you know, when it is a part, definitely it's something that you need to talk to someone about and explore, you know, what they're doing. I think like you said there at the start, everyone is different, and so you know, it's really hard to kind of almost like say a broad sense of what you do. But I think first of all, it's exploring, you know, what the person is doing, and depending on, you know, their physical status, you know. So I suppose when we're working with people with eating disorders, you know, the first, you know, and foremost thing that we're thinking about as dietitians or practitioners is about risk. And so, you know, if someone's physical health is deteriorating because maybe they're losing weight, or even if they're not losing weight, you know, they can still be at physical risk. If there's changes, you know, to their heart function or, you know, different things like that, then, you know, we'd be definitely telling people not to be exercising. Or if they were struggling with that, definitely, you know, advising to be reducing and moving towards stopping. So I think it really just depends on kind of where someone's at and the risk. But certainly you'd be looking at that at the start. So thinking about risk, and then, you know, I suppose typically people will find stopping, if they're exercising already, they'll typically find stopping really difficult. So, you know, if someone was really adamant that they couldn't stop, you know, I would kind of explain the risk. But then if they were kind of saying that they couldn't stop, then you'd be trying to support them to reduce it or change it in some way to kind of reduce that risk further. And then obviously advising them to link in with the GP and their team to be able to manage the risk. So, yes, I think, you know, it's always a conversation that you're having with someone about activity. And for sure, it is something that sometimes as dietitians, we have to encourage people or, you know, advise people to stop because of the risk. And then introducing it back in then is a kind of a different, you know, a different approach, I suppose, as well. So there's different things to consider when you're starting to bring it back in.
If someone wasn't at a physical risk, let's say, but they came, but you kind of, you know, explored their relationship with exercise and they said, I just can't stop. In that kind of scenario, would it be a case of
supporting them with stopping exercise, because obviously they're not at a physical risk, but mentally I think that can be so overwhelming and can really halt somebody in their recovery?
So for sure, I think any kind of, you know, obsessive thing that someone's doing that, you know, affects their, you know, their relationship with food or exercise, then yes, you're going to be supporting them to reduce it and stop it, because I think ultimately you're looking at that relationship with exercise. And if someone's over exercising and it's getting in the way of their social life, or, you know, they're going out exercising in the rain, or, you know, they're not fueling that exercise, so they're maybe their physical health, you know, is the same, but they're not actually eating sufficiently, you know, that's not a positive, healthy relationship with exercise. So you have to kind of get them to kind of pull back from it, or even stop it in some cases, to then get them back to a place where they can be healthy and bring it back in a healthy kind of managed, you know, way, you know, for them to improve that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And when would you say would be the right time?
Getting all of the balance in, you know, having a wide variety of food, you know, being open to adding in additional nutrition. So, you know, if they're doing moderate to intense exercise, they will need additional nutrition on those days that they're doing that activity. So they need to be, you know, willing and open to be taking on board extra nutrition on those days. So that's really, really important. I think also, you know, the kind of the physical side as well. So making sure that, you know, that their weight, if their weight had dropped, that their weight is kind of up to a more of a healthy level. for their body, because there's risks when you're exercising at a lower weight. If they're, we wouldn't typically, stop or, tell someone that they can't be exercising if their menstrual cycle hasn't, returned back. But, you would hope that, the menstrual cycle will be coming back, within a few months or a month of starting to kind of do exercise again. So there's those kind of physical aspects that you'd be looking at. So first thing is really, are they getting enough in? And then thinking about the physical side, like the weight or the hormones and what's kind of going on in the body.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just, it's so important, isn't it, to make sure that you are at a place where, not only physically your body is able to exercise, but mentally as well. Like, I know personally, throughout my recovery, like, exercise has been something that has not stopped for me. And I almost, I question how productive that's been, because it's still the thing that has got the grasp on me. But because I was never in a physically compromised state, it wasn't something that I needed to stop. But then that almost makes you think, oh, well, I'm okay to keep exercising then, because I'm not, physically compromised or whatever. And I think then that builds that personality around the exercise. And I don't know whether you've had experience of this, but I know for me that when I've not really been engaging in like the anorexic behaviors,
it's okay for me to eat because I'm still exercising.
Like, we call it kind of bouncing over to another behavior, and the exercise can be part of it. I think, when exercise is part of your eating disorder and you have, you're in a recovery mindset, I think it's really important that you're honest about your relationship with exercise. And if that means that for a period of time that you have to stop for you to develop and improve your relationship with exercise, then that's going to be beneficial for you. You know, whether you are or you are not physically compromised, it doesn't really matter. It's about that relationship and, the hold that that's having over your life. If you're only allowed to have your lunch because, you're going to the gym later or having a run, that's not a positive relationship with food or exercise. So, you need to be able to eat that sandwich and yogurt and manage, throughout the day, and cope with those feelings that might come up from having that meal, and without kind of responding, to that stress or anxiety with exercise. So it's really hard because, I do loads of sport. I know the benefit of exercise. We know that the way it improves our mood and makes us feel good. So obviously when someone has an eating disorder, they do want to improve their mood and feel better. But it can't be initially, I don't think, through exercise. Or at least it has to be, slowly introduced. They have to almost find something new to help improve their mood or boost their mood in the interim, if they're a sports person, then they're going to be bringing that more in, probably in a more consistent way. If they're just kind of, a recreational, activity person, then that would be a bit different. But it's finding some other things, I think, which are going to kind of bring you joy in the interim, whilst you're trying to manage and deal with that relationship, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that I personally really struggled with, was finding joy outside of the exercise, and just simple things like, I'd go for a walk with my mum, but then that walk became a compulsive walk because I wasn't doing the other exercise. And it very quickly just closes in on everything, and everything becomes that compulsive exercise. But then, for me, having activities that weren't kind of, that didn't involve a little bit of movement, felt too overwhelming. So it's really finding that balance. And like you said, I really like that in terms of like being able to sit after a meal, rather than getting up and going for a walk after you've eaten.
They're in the habit of responding to that stress or guilt or fear or anxiety with movement, whether it's getting up and going for a walk or just getting up and going out to the gym. So, you need to work towards changing that habit and trying to soothe yourself in different ways, which is really, really challenging for people. But once you start to do that and do it consistently, then it does kind of improve and settle. But it's practicing that and applying that and trying to change that kind of reactive behavior of like, I'm feeling bad, now I'm going to go walking. It's like trying to kind of manage that in some way that's different, to support you better.
Yeah. The really interesting thing I found as well was like you said, you know, a lot of people, it's not something that just kind of happened 2 months ago and then, you know, it's something that's maybe been going on for a while. For me, I remember when I first went to my therapist and she was like, yeah, I think you know, you are a compulsive exerciser and I think you've got an issue with exercise. And I was like, no, I don't. And she was like, okay, can you have a day, like, does exercise make you feel better? Like, do you have to exercise in order to feel fine? And I was like, no, that's not why I exercise. And it took ages for me to realize that I was no longer using the exercise to feel good. I just was in such an automatic routine that I was terrified if I don't do the exercise, then I won't feel like, you know, this normal level. It wasn't, you know, people would talk about this like endorphin high or whatever, and I'd be like, I do not get that. But it had become, I was so worried about the anxiety it would provoke if I didn't go, because it had been going on for so long, that made it almost like a double thing to combat, because it wasn't, it was the anxiety before the exercise, before it even started. So then it was that fear of the unknown of what will happen now. So I guess just to sort of round us off, you said about kind of, you know, being able to soothe yourself using other things rather than exercise. And I always like to sort of, you know, give some tips and advice to people.
And obviously everyone is different, but do you have any tips for people to self-soothe rather than leaning on to exercise?
I think it's about being open, you know, to some things, you know. You know, I said to you already, Hannah, that I teach yoga and meditation. So I'd be a big advocate of those things in, you know, different forms. So I'm not saying that, you know, if you're not used to meditating, then, you know, go out tomorrow and just sit on a cushion and try and meditate. You know, it has to be the right type of meditation and, you know, the right style. But I think certainly I would promote those kind of things, because, you know, meditation or breath work or mindfulness or just gentle restorative slow yoga or Tai Chi, you know, they have this benefit of kind of, you know, supporting our nervous system. So, you know, tapping into that kind of parasympathetic nervous system where we're grounded and relaxed and, you know, we can kind of, you know, have our rational mind coming in. Typically when someone's, you know, post a meal or having had like a food that causes anxiety, they're in that kind of fight or flight state. So, you know, meditation, breathwork, yoga, all those things I've said can help someone kind of go back into that sympathetic or parasympathetic place and just kind of ground, you know, after, you know, that maybe difficult thing. So definitely would be an advocate of those things, probably a bit biased there. And also I think creative things as well, you know, so, you know, colouring or music or art, all of those things are really nice, you know, using your hands to kind of create things, I think can be really helpful. And then, you know, you have kind of those other kind of self-care things like, you know, doing your nails or your hair or, you know, putting on a face mask, you know, things like that, that are kind of really nice things for us to do for ourselves that, you know, take us away from maybe thoughts or that kind of thing.
No, I think they're really nice ideas.
I think, yeah, it's like finding the right thing. I think finding the right one that suits you, because the more, you know, you do these practices consistently, the more benefit they have for you. And the more you'll find that they can improve your well-being, I would say.
Well, thank you so much. Have a lovely rest of your Sunday. And yeah, thanks for coming on.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.